So we move on to the primary financial statements with Michelle Fisher.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for being here on this very cold day.
Yes, I'm one or two men down. So I'll start with, I think it's agenda paper 2A. I'll start with paper agenda 2A and I'll talk you through the slides. Most of you will be quite familiar with the primary financial statement project as we've been discussing it at the last few CMAT meetings. However, for the benefit of new members, the aim of the project is targeted improvements to the structure and content of the primary financial statement, with a focus on the statement of financial performance, so the income statement. And now slide 2 in the deck shows the purpose of the first part of the primary financial statement session today, which is to seek your feedback on requirements for management performance measures and management adjusted EPS. Now, one of the main benefits we've heard from investors about developing requirements for management performance measures and adjusted EPS is that these alternative performance measures showing management's view of performance will be in the financial statements where they'll be subject to audit and perhaps greater transparency than they would be otherwise. Now, the board is still very much in the process of discussing the requirements for management performance measures, so your input today will greatly help the discussion. Now, the background slides on slide 4 and 5 provide a reminder of the past discussions that we've had with CMAC about the management performance measure. When we first discussed it with you back in June, we introduced it as part of proposals to introduce two subtotals into the statement of financial performance, as shown on slide 4. Now, we proposed that we would introduce a standardised EBIT subtotal to provide comparability between entities for investors' analysis, and also a management performance subtotal that could provide management's view of performance. Now, these proposals were intended to address the conflicting needs for additional comparability that investors were asking for, and preparers were also asking for us to retain flexibility for them to show their view of performance. Now, slide 5 shows the feedback that we received from GPF and CMAP members at the joint meeting in June. Most members were supportive of our proposals to bring in a management performance measure. The merits included greater transparency and inclusion in the scope of the audit. However, some members expressed concern about having management performance measures in the financial statements. And some members noted that it would be better to have greater disaggregation in the income statement. Now, we are planning to bring proposals for aggregation disaggregation principles to the board probably around about in April time. And now, during our discussions since the June CMAC-GPF meeting, we found it quite difficult to balance our objective of both introducing greater comparability and also retaining flexibility for preparers. And because these needs conflict with each other, because the more comparable a structure we develop, the more restrictions there will be on management performance measures in the income statement. Now, for this reason, in September, the board decided to prioritise introducing comparable subtotals to facilitate comparisons between entities over introducing these management performance measures. Now, through these discussions, we've developed the proposed structure, which is shown on slide 7. The proposed structure is also described on slide 8, and it consists of two required subtotals and two defined categories. The categories are income and expenses from investments and finance income and expense. IS1 already requires a bifunction by nature analysis. However, at recent board meetings, the board have decided to require this analysis to be presented in the income statement, whereas previously it was permitted to be disclosed in the notes, and has also proposed further guidance on its presentation. Also, for any additional subtotals included in IS1, any additional subtotals included in the income statement in accordance with IS1, they would need to adhere to the requirements shown on the bottom half of slide 8. And now we have this tentative structure in place, the board is now discussing how a management performance measure might fit within that structure. So slide 10 gives an overview of what we're meaning by management performance measures. Now, so far in our discussions about management performance measure, the board has been considering a proposal where a management performance measure would be presented as a subtotal in the income statement if it fits in the board's proposed structure for the statement, and if it also satisfies the requirements in IS1 for subtotals, including providing relevant information. Now, as you can see from slides 7 and 8, the proposed structure is relatively strict about where different income and expenses could be presented. And so we think that the management performance measure in many cases may not fit in any income statement. Now, in which case the board is discussing a proposal whereby companies would provide a separate reconciliation in the notes between the management performance measure and the subtotal specifically required by IFRS standards. For example, this might be the EBIT subtotal that we're proposing to bring in. If the management performance measure is presented in the income statement, there may be no need to have that additional reconciliation in the notes. However, the board's currently discussing the benefits of requiring the reconciliation in the notes for all entities, even if it's on the face. So slide 11 and slide 12 provide an illustration of how the management performance measure might look like if it's presented in the income statement and if it's presented in a separate reconciliation in the notes. So moving on to the adjusted EPS, some investors have told us that they find management performance measures useful because they provide information about management's view of performance, and because they can often help users to assess the persistence or sustainability of an entity's financial performance. This is often because management includes items that it identifies as non-recurring items. Now, for the same reason, we've heard that investors would like to see management's adjusted EPS, and that would be useful for their analysis, because it would show how the effects of management's exclusions on the basic or diluted earnings per share figure. However, we've heard some concerns about the way adjusted EPS is currently being presented by companies, and these are shown on slide 14. Now, slide 15 shows the way we might consider addressing these concerns, but so far the board has not yet had any discussions on the adjusted EPS. We've heard that requiring all companies to provide an adjusted EPS that's calculated consistently with the management performance measures would be useful to investors, because it would show how adjustments that management makes to the management performance measure would filter down to the EPS figure. So, for example, if a company's management performance measure is an operating profit that excludes restructuring costs and share-based payments, the requirement would be for them to calculate it to an adjusted earnings per share figure that also excludes those items. However, the staff have heard that the adjusted EPS figure may have limited benefits unless it's also accompanied by an explanation of the differences between the exclusions from the management performance measure and the exclusions from the adjusted EPS, and also the effect of tax and non-controlling interest for each item excluded from those measures. This is so that users can calculate their own EPS measure for their analysis and in order to make comparisons with other companies. Now, the illustration on slide 6 shows one way this might be done. Slide 2 shows a more detailed illustration. And we'd really appreciate your views on whether the disclosure on slide 16 or slide 22 would be useful to you. So now plan to move to the questions. We would like probably to spend a bit more time on question 2 than question 1 if time permits.
Thank you, Michelle. I mean, maybe before we jump into the discussion, are there any questions to the board? To Michelle? Okay, Mitch.
I have one question. Is what if this is implemented, what impact will it have on historical reporting? So if someone reports, once this is reports their annual numbers or other quarterly numbers, are they required to present like-for-like numbers with the adjustments?
You mean for a length period of time?
Yeah, so for example, historically someone may have been reporting in their press release adjusted, EBITDA or adjusted earnings, and there was a reconciliation there, or maybe there wasn't, and then this becomes standardized. What about how, what the requirements would be for historical reports?
Well, under the current requirements, they would obviously be required to present comparative figures, so comparative for 5 years.
Just want everything to be like for like.
That would probably just be the immediate prior year. It wouldn't necessarily be historical summer. So there would need to be a separate debate about whether that would extend to historical summer.
For me, at least, whatever is being often in an annual report, not in quarterlies, but Northern quarterlies are obviously just 1 year, but in the historical, sometimes you see 3 years. So just whatever is being presented, which helps to have the consistency through time.
Thank you, James.
Yes, please. So, first of all, slide 7. Can you explain to me where you would put equity accounted, joint ventures, etc., in where that would fit into the scheme on slide 7?
We'll be discussing that in the second part of the session.
Right. So currently it's not. Right. Okay. Secondly, on slide 10, maybe you've all, I don't know, I'm a newcomer, so you've all had this discussion before. I wanted to understand if between the blue management performance measure and profit before investing, financing, and income tax, is it foreseen that somewhere with this restructuring expenses, large single amortizations, write-offs, intangible, etc., are going to be there, or are they going to be above the blue line?
Above the blue line, what do you mean, sorry?
Management performance measure.
Well, the under our proposals, we think in many cases that the management performance measure won't fit within the proposed structure of the income statement.
Right.
It would have to fit into the proposed structure. So, for example, if a company presented a by-function analysis in the income statement, it wouldn't then be able to exclude expenses on by-nature basis under the proposed structure. So it would often be that these management performance measures are provided in a separate reconciliation in the notes.
So it's reconciliation is the route you're going down.
Pardon, sorry?
So am I to understand, possibly being very stupid here, but am I to understand that your preferred route is a reconciliation statement?
Well, it would be if it didn't fit in on the face of the income statement. But the board is still discussing this and hasn't come to conclusions. But it would just be that the reconciliation would be provided on the face of the income statement if it fits. But if it doesn't fit, the reconciliation would be provided in a separate reconciliation.
So just to clarify, Michelle's absolutely right, but what we're not proposing is set rules in terms of what can be in or out of a management performance measure. It's really what the company decides, and as Michelle says, as long as we have that clear reconciliation in terms of what the company has put in that measure.
And thirdly, probably again, these are discussions you've had, is there any room for an EBITDA measure at all on where it can fit on the financial statements?
I think if a company presents a by nature analysis, it would be possible for an EBITDA figure to be included in there. But if it had presented a by function analysis in the income statement, that it wouldn't fit.
Right.
Something we've been looking at in the Principles of Disclosure project.
Okay. Thank you.
So my question was actually somewhat similar to James. I think you've already clarified it partly. But basically, I mean, so the purpose is essentially just to force companies to have a clear reconciliation, whereas at the moment, maybe some companies aren't being completely clear as to what is being included and excluded and what it's coming from. And, you know, it all needs to be, you're going to categorize sort of the nature of items. So if somebody says, okay, we want to strip out, you know, the intangibles amortization, they can do that, but then they have to calculate that intangibles amortization under IFRS, or how should we imagine that? Because I'm just trying to understand how this is going to differ from the way it's being done now by most companies. And also, once companies actually do this in the financial statements, would they then still be free outside of the financial statements to present some sort of a different measure. And I guess it's not so relevant now because you're saying that they're free to choose what goes in and what cannot be in. But if they were to say, okay, you know, there are just, you know, certain elements within the financial statements that we would actually like to strip out of our standard management performance measure, but then there is another metric that we look at that we think is maybe not quite clean, but it also helps people understand the business. I mean, that would obviously invite confusion and scrutiny, but it would be helpful to understand, you know, if that will still be allowed then, or if basically this moves everything into the financial statement and people cannot do any other calculations outside of the financial statements.
And one of the proposals we're discussing, we were discussing, because I mean it would be difficult to enforce to require all companies to present their alternative performance measures that are presented outside the financial statements in the financial statements, but we're discussing a proposal where a company would be at least required to identify those in the annual report and disclose them in the financial statements. And it may be, I mean, we see a key benefit of including them in the financial statements is increased transparency, improving the disclosures. But it may be, if the regulation is very strong in the jurisdiction that company's in, that it may be that it's already a requirement to provide these kind of disclosures already, but outside the financial statements.
I don't know, I think Martin was next.
If you look at slide 7, one of the reasons why we're such a proponent of a strong EBIT, because currently some companies use the line item other financial expense as something to more or less transfer expenses below operating income. And here I see other financial expense. And this is one of the things that that immediately as an analyst you zoom into, are these proper finance expenses, or actually are they operating? And I just wonder, is the ISB really going to make a strong definition of limited definition of what is eligible to become a finance expense, or is that going to be up to management? I mean, that's a key worry. And given that for some companies this is a practice, trying to get the management definition of an operating income in the financial statement will cause some companies to, if you want to make it all add up, to see all the normal line items and then some sort of a add back of finance expenses to get to their management definition, which they then need to deduct later on again. And I'm not sure if this is going to work in practice. Theoretically it could fit. You could still make it fit by adding things up and deducting, but it would become a bit of a mess. So the criterion of will it fit is maybe not stringent enough, because you can make it fit by making all kinds of adductions and of things that I'm actually quite hesitant to put it in there, as it could in many cases confuse analysts to bring it in the primary financial statements.
I guess the reality is many companies already have them on the face, as subtotals in terms of how they fit within requirements of IS1. And it's really using that as a framework. And I don't think that took me long, that add back situation would be allowed.
No, I wouldn't.
What we're talking about.
It would not be allowed.
Yes, we haven't specifically discussed it, but we've developed a principles definition of finance income and expense and investing income and expense. So, I mean, they're principle based, so there is obviously room for some element of judgment, but we would like to think that, you know, if something was a finance income and expense or an investing income and expense, that it couldn't then be included in the operating section and then deducted and then added back.
Bertrand?
Yes, thank you. I have a question relating to the chart 8, to the slide 8. We have the paragraph 85 of IS1. Is there any overlapping between what is required with this paragraph and the management performance measure, or is it two different things?
We have actually been discussing at the meeting the overlap between the requirements we already have in IS1 for additional subtotals and the management performance measure subtotals. So we are considering how to link those two. We haven't come to a conclusion.
Glenn?
I confess, when I look at this, it leaves me completely kind of indifferent. And I wonder why, there's a difference. We have to be careful here. There's a difference between an accounting approach that says to a company, you have this information confidentially and it's non-public, and we would like to make it public so that people can use it. So that's one of the purposes of accounting standards, is to extract what is essentially non-public and to make it available to everyone publicly on a equal footing. Then there's a second question, which is the one I think that we're kind of debating here, which is how do we end the debate about how to classify the information that is out in the public domain? And to be honest, I don't think the accounting standards can achieve that, because the debate is what the market is all about. The market is contesting this stuff all the time. So management performance standard, I mean, this is the heart of what the market's about. And it isn't going to be settled by an accounting standard, because you publish this stuff and you say, it should be classified in this, and there'll be someone out there who says, no, we have to add this, we have to add this, we have to take that off, we have to take that off. And then there'll be another set of people producing another set.
I don't think that's the intention at all. So there's no definition around what the management performance measure. It's up to the company to define what the management.
But they do that already.
They do that. So the raison d'etre here is to actually provide some better reconciliation around that number and transparency around that number. Now, that happens very well in some jurisdictions already, in some regulatory environments, but not in all regulatory environments at the moment. So there was a debate whether the board should, for instance, define recurring, non-recurring. The board has decided not to go down that route, because you just end up with an adjusted measure on an adjusted measure.
Right.
And as you say, the market decides and has that dispute. So this is really trying to provide some creative two things. For management to express their view of what a key measure is in terms of how they run the company, but then to provide some clarity and some rich reconciliation around that number.
But you need a principle that draws a line between the two, because you don't have to tell, honestly, the Accounting Standards Board does not have to tell management that they have to explain what management performance is, because they do that whatever you say and whatever anybody else says. They're going to say, I know we made a huge loss, but actually, if you look at the underlying profits, we made a huge profit. And all you have to do is take away all the losses and that's it. And they're doing that all the time, regardless of what the standards say. And that's a good thing, because the market's going to sit there and say, well, yeah, I agree with that, I don't agree with that, agree with that, don't agree with that. And five investors will read seven answers about what is the right thing to do, and then we'll all go and buy and sell the shares until we settle the until the market settles it. And it's never even settled for even a day. It can change. So we need a principle that says that what the standard is doing is not trying to settle a debate that is occurring in the market about classification or about what is reasonable, because that the market will do by itself. But what we're really trying to do is, as you say, is to throw light on an area where there's shade, where there's a bit of darkness, we're going to put,
that's
we're
going to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. But just to clarify your response, Nick, so if, for example, you would define, for example, restructuring expenses, and then if the company basically presents a management measure that is based on add-back restructuring expenses that are higher than the restructuring expenses in IFRS, they would need to explain that? Is that
I don't think that, Peter. I don't think we define restructuring or our intentions to do so. No.
Okay, thank you. Just a reminder, we're still just trying to ask clarifying questions to the IASB. So we'll get into the discussion in a second. Next was Salah.
Sure. I just want to echo a few of the points that were made. I mean, just to express an opinion on this, I think it would add greater confusion, just purely, given that we're giving so much flexibility to the definition. And we spend a lot of time reclassify non-reoccurring and reoccurring items, and then, you know, how would that work if you're showing extraordinary items and then these are being adjusted for, you know, in this single line item? I think that, you know, I understand the, you know, the rationale behind having this, but I think having a separate reconciliation will probably be the best way to go around this. And then to echo, I mean, just to give an example, so Novartis, for example, have their own metric, this Novartis value added, okay, which is effectively an EVA measure. That doesn't really fit within this. And there's the wider issue here. I mean, if you were to compare in the US the 10Ks and the standardized formats they have here, we have a huge amount of, you know, problem. I mean, we have a database that covers 20,000 companies, but in Europe, you know, the fact that each annual report has a slightly different presentation is a bit of a challenge for us. So adding this would certainly blur the lines somewhat as well.
We actually think under our proposals that our proposals will be more restrictive than what's currently required on the income statement, because we envisage in most cases that these management performance measures will actually just be in a note disclosure, because in order to fit on the face of the income statement, they'd have to meet all the requirements shown on slide 8. So they'd have to meet the requirements for additional subtotals in IS1, they'd have to be relevant, and they'd have to fit in our proposed structure, which is now a more restrictive structure than we currently have.
So you're dictating the performance measure?
We wouldn't be dictating perhaps what can go on the face, but there would be no constraints on the management performance measure presented in the notes.
Sorry, if it doesn't fit on the face, the requirement, then would it be simply a reconciliation in the notes instead of? So it can only go on the face if it fits into that structure. And I say there are many of those measures today, and if they don't, it would then have to be a reconciliation in the notes.
Just in between, because suppose it fits, is the reconciliation still required then?
That is something which we've been debating.
Because I'm a bit worried that we have maybe like 30% of companies having it in the primary reference statements. And then, I mean, as an analyst community, you want to be able to do also mass processing of financial statements. So I would say always require the separate reconciliation.
Absolutely.
Always.
Okay.
And indeed, if it fits, I mean, if it... You can note the management performance measure in a financial statement, but not part as a subtotal. Just note it that there is, then you solve one problem, because the relevance of the management performance, what's the MPM, there is relevance to it. And I see the logic that that many also third-party data providers will try to include that MPM in their presentation. But I'm not sure if you want to do all the corrections in the primary financial statement, because that will become a mess. And people will be puzzled, is this a correction or is this a real element of the primary financial statement? And that confusion will cause trouble.
But it's the reconciliation that might time need. If you've got it on the face, and if you look at the example on slide 11, in a sense the reconciliation is already there anyway.
Yeah, but that's I am sure that you can come up with an example where it all works out, but in real life I think there will be probably many examples where there will be more than just simply a deduction. It's just moving from. There will be more complex adjustments than this one. I mentioned the financial expenses. I mean, if you want to, as a company, exclude certain other financial expenses, you already get a mess. And that's currently being done by many companies. And I expect that the ISB will come up with a forceful EBIT definition, which will cause some companies to do some add-backs of other financial expenses before getting to the MPM, and that's going to be a mess.
Sorry, I still don't understand your responses to the questions earlier, which is So if, you know, a company actually, one of their recon items is an item that the IFRS is not defining. So let's say, you know, a lot of companies add back restructuring. You say you're not even going to attempt to define restructuring. So in the notes of the financial statement, they're not going to be able to put that on the face of the financial statement then for that reason, I suppose. But they do the recon in the notes. And so in the notes, you got this recon item restructuring. And suddenly auditors are going to be forced to audit this, even though, you know, nobody knows what it is and it's a number that the company has freely made up. Oh, sorry, confused here.
I mean, I think it can go on the face today. The examples, we see many examples of it on the face today, having that, and it fits within the requirements of IS1, paragraph 85. I mean, that isn't something new that's being proposed.
But then what is the audit requirement around that? Because I think Stocky Advances is going to be audited, but if these numbers aren't defined, they can't be audited, right?
I guess the requirement is around looking at that totality of the reconciliation.
Okay.
And the amount, and often multiple amounts.
And they can be audited even if they're not defined.
They should be.
Okay, so before we move to Gora, I would just suggest that at this point we also open for commentary on questions 1 and 2. So anyone who actually wants to comment as opposed to just ask a question, please feel free to put your sign up now as well. And Gora, you have the next one.
Okay, I want to, if I remember it correctly, that the original idea was that in the income statement, something which can be used as anchor to the alternative performance measures or MPM, right? So that all these MPMs or alternative performance are disclosed outside financial statement right now. But the, one of the problem I believe that the, is that we do not have any standardized, you know, line items or subtotals. So that I believe that one of the major motivation of this project was to establish something we can use at the anchor. We hope that to be something like operating profit, but we found, I believe that in the FIMAT meeting, that it was very difficult for us to define operating profits in a principal basis. Therefore, instead, we introduced such idea as EBIT, but we found that even EBIT, that distinction between financial and operation could be difficult. So I understand, if I understand it correctly, we are now introducing that the profit before investing, financing, and tax, income taxes.
Yeah.
So that now we have two anchors here, and then MPM, which should be reconciled back to either of these two.
Yes.
Is that the idea?
Yes, that's it, yeah.
Okay. And when we look at the next paper, you'll see that how we accommodate associates and joint ventures, and that provides potentially another anchor point as well. But you're right, it was trying to provide those anchors.
Do you just want to read out the questions again before we continue, and then we move on to Osram?
You have on slides 18 and slide 18 and slide 19, you have the question. So as Michelle mentioned, she wanted to devote some time to the second question, which is what you would find an adjusted EPS that's consistently calculated with the management performance measure useful, and would you find the disclosures about the tax and the NCI effects of those adjustments to the MPM and the adjusted EPS also helpful? And also some perspective on maybe how you would use that information.
So I'm not going to answer that question. but I just wanted to go back to maybe slide 11. So first of all, I think, Nick, what you said in terms of what the aim is, you know, we already get management view. The aim is to kind of bring it into a more formal basis, give a greater level of reconciliation. I think I would agree with both of those. I think for me what's missing perhaps, and we talked about this previous CMAX, is one thing that's frustrating about APMs, we do have that reconciliation. It is a management view, which is fine. The frustrating point about it is it's a skewed view, and
it changes from year to year depending what profit target the company wants to achieve. Yeah. So I think what's missing from here, maybe it is already in your thought process, just not covered here, is I'd really want a very, very clear management definition of what they consider as non-recurring, what they consider as restructuring, what they consider as they would put in or extract from their own measures.
Yeah.
Even if in 1 year that number happens to be zero, but in future years, and when that changes, I'd want to understand why they changed it, because I think that would really help to kind of bring some discipline to those manage perform measures over time.
Yeah, that is our intention.
I think that's the missing piece of the jigsaw here.
The board has discussed that, and it's very much in line with what you say in terms of the tentative discussion the board has made.
So and any change must be, any change to the MPM must be disclosed in your notes, right?
I think they should define how they've come up with this MPM, what goes in, what goes out, even if the number is zero in some years. The other question is, how does this work in slide 11, for example, how does this work for financial services, for banks or insurers?
We haven't discussed financial services yet.
Best for last.
Okay, Mitch?
Question for clarification purposes is in some ways the purpose of this to make it more restrictive for these items to go on the income statement or the primary statements. Are you essentially trying to drive this off into, you make it more restrictive and trying to just drive off these management performance measures off the primary statements and say we want you to disclose it more restrictive, but you have to disclose it elsewhere in the reports?
Our intention was really to bring in more comparability into the income statement, and a consequence of that means that it may be less likely that some of these management performance measures can fit in there. But our intention...
I think it creates a little bit of confusion of why a company would put it on or off or...
I think we're trying to be pragmatic, and many of these measures are there today. Prepare us to present them there today within our existing rules on the face. And I think we said if that still makes sense and the reconciliation is clear on the face, we would let them continue to do that. Most of them we see would be too complex to go on the face, and hence they would be in the notes. Now I'm hearing different views around the room whether that is helpful or unhelpful, having that in one place in some circumstances and another place under different circumstances. But it wasn't about driving them off the face. That hasn't been our intention.
It feels like the way this is structured, the slide 11 example, most of the time it'd have to be off the face because you'd have lots of kind of investing in interest items that would be in the MPM.
Yeah.
And that makes me think, why not just make it all off the face anyway? But then that also makes me think that the point that I think somebody raised about, well, will this mean yet another metric that's in the financials, but actually they'll still use their own metrics in the front half of their reporting outside of this completely?
But if that were the case, wouldn't it just mean that you would just have to do another disclosure, so you wouldn't do it anyway? You can't have, you have your adjusted EBITDA and then your adjusted EBITDA? Then you'd have another disclosure that, I think that is a marginal risk. In my opinion, I think it's going to be someone's going to do the EBITDA number or the adjusted EBITDA number. We want an IFRS reconciliation of that so we can do the maths. That's all, I mean, it's true that some do it in their press releases anyway, but it's certainly not universal across statements, across jurisdictions, and that's what you're after. On the question that we're supposed to answer, and quick follow, is it that put the reconciliation just below the statements or in the notes? Is that basically what you're asking us?
Well, that's what we would like feedback on in question one.
Just where the location of the reconciliation would be.
Well, the board did discuss whether the reconciliation should form part of the primary financial statements or whether it would be better in the notes, and has taken the tentative decision that it would be better in the notes. But we were just, one of the questions was to seek your feedback on whether you would want that disclosure more prominently.
It sounds like the majority can't even be in the primary statements anyway, so then...
But it would be almost like a footnote following the statement of financial performance.
From a practical point of view, that would be the easiest, because if you're spreading numbers, then it's right on the same page that you're looking at the primary statements from a practical point. I mean, in some ways, it's kind of a secondary question, but just in practical matters, you're just taking the numbers, it's just easier if it's right next to the financial statements. Just as when you look at the cash flow statement, cash uses for cash interest, and taxes are just below the cash flow statement, it just makes it a lot easier. You don't have to go around searching stuff. From a practical point of view, if it's not going to be in, if these management performance measures are not going to be in the statements, then yeah, might as well put them close by from a practical point of view. So, and the second question, I don't really have a view being a credit guy. I never look at EPS anyway.
Jeff, and then Martin, and then James.
Okay. I mean, just picking up what you've just said there, reconciliation just below the face of the income statement, I think, would be quite encouraging for our work. With our analysts jumping around the accounts, hunting, being a detective, to try and find recurring and non-recurring items is... they can just miss things quite easily. I still wouldn't, I'm just getting old now, I just don't trust anything or anybody, so put something on the face as a performance measure. I enjoy the fact I don't trust it because I'm going to try and find something else. And you've got that reconciliation between the subjective and the objective, so I think on the face it's kind of useful. On the EPS, on the taxes, you see, when I'll speak about the sell side, part of my job is to kind of encourage our analysts to be better analysts, and I look at effective tax rates as a crutch that analysts use to do their forecasting. You know, like the effective tax rate was 25% last year, be 25% next year, and the year after, and the year after, and the year after. You try and do that with the US tax reform, you are so incredibly wrong. So anything that I can get where I get an insight to the tax implications of the exceptionals, I would find that very useful. Because sometimes you get it, I mean, Diageo's accounts is very good on the exceptional disclosure, particularly on the taxes, then you get other sets of accounts where you've just got no idea. And then you're trying to guess on a marginal tax basis what the tax implications are, and that's kind of hard.
Martin?
Yeah. I'd like to focus on question two. When I look at the proposed format, I see a single column with tax and NCI. I think the nature of tax and the nature of NCI is so totally different that they should never be added up in a single column. I would not support this. I would add separate columns for those, because else you still don't know where it's NCI or tax. Even though the NCI amount may be very small, it could be in these individual line items, it could be quite big, and we don't know.
Slide 22 shows an alternative approach that would do, as you suggest, separating tax and NCI.
Yeah, but I'm talking about slide 16 now, so yeah. Great that 22 is already improvement. That's quite and yes, useful. I think it will be useful because there is a wide community that's still focused on EPS. I think,
I've been asked to opine. I have been an equity analyst before as well. I'm not quite sure whether I've got a different set of slides from Martin.
I think there are different slides.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I've seen tax as a separate column. I think the one I've got tax is a row rather than a column.
Which page are you looking at, James?
22.
14.
Okay.
So tax is a row in 22, but tax and NCI are split across two rows. So that attends to Martin's point, so that you can see the tax separately.
So the alternative to me, I think the alternative is something I would favour. That's obviously, I'm not an equity analyst now, so the first question is still more relevant to me. I would back what Jeff said, in a way also kind of backing what Martin said. In all cases, even if you choose to have the management performance measure on the primary income statement, I think something that would come under the comprehensive income statement as this MPM reconciliation, not in somewhere that may in interims be note 29, may in full year accounts be note 72. I think it would just make a lot of sense just to have it under comprehensive income. Not within comprehensive income, but just after. That's my two pennies worth. Thank you.
I don't want to go on about this, but I just want to make the point again, which is that when it comes to these performance metrics, because the thing I'm worried about is that people will start getting misled by some of this stuff. If you look at the modern corporation, the modern global corporation that has produced most of the value in the last decade, these are these global value corporations that have subcontracted their operations, manufacture operations to China, services go off in different places, etc. Where do they make, where's the value, management value in this? The answer is a lot of the value in this has been able to be, to isolate patents and those sort of things. Capital structure has been a big part of it. Managing just-in-time value chains, but the critical part of it has been getting the financing cost of those chains down because they're basically reducing it. And of course, a huge part of it has been tax management. Just a huge part. The model that we have here is of a traditional manufacturing corporation operating in a single jurisdiction, and then we're looking at them. Sometimes this is a good idea, but for most of the big corporations that we're looking at, this kind of model, I think, you know, if you look at some, I don't want to name the names, but if you look at some of the big corporations, you ask, where's the value? The answer is that they've got the tax right. That's the value. That's the value. They've got the tax down to virtually zero. And that's what's driving the huge value in the corporations. You know, tax, moving it around and putting the patents in Bermuda, and the cash is sitting somewhere else, and the operations are in China, and the sales are global. They pay no taxes. This is the value. Let's be cynical. This is about where in the management performance measure do we capture that kind of value added? Which, I mean, let's face it, stock prices reflect all of that, right? It's the ones that stayed at home and didn't contract out the manufacturing and didn't move all this stuff offshore and all that kind of stuff. They're the ones that didn't produce the value. So when we compare the two, if we have this MPM, we say the ones that actually did the worst are actually the ones that have done well on MPM, and the ones that have really done the best have done the worst. You know, I think you could get. I think you have to be very careful about this, because you could actually end up misleading. I think, as we said, now we exclude a huge sector, which is the financials, from this. We will probably end up excluding all the services sector, where in the services we're talking about this kind of stuff. And really what we have in mind when we're looking at this is a kind of very traditional manufacturing business that is in a single jurisdiction, that is basically not able to or not willing to move around its capital structure very much or to move around its tax very much. And that's not how most of the corporations, at least in the last 20 years, have delivered value. I think you have to be careful about the MPMs in that sense when you look at it like that.
But the whole point of this is that the board is not instructing companies to produce MPMs, and it's not instructing them how to produce them. The model is companies are producing them. This is constraining it and giving us more understanding and disclosure and insight into it. I don't actually understand the
until
point
you
you're making.
Until you put a standard down, if you're going to put a standard, everyone has to follow it. If you're just creating another option, you know, that there's no point. If you're creating a standard that says, this is the standard that everyone shall follow, then we need to understand what it is that that we've reached consensus on.
Well, the requirement, actually, the standard is around the reconciliation exposing the numbers rather than defining what a management performance number would be. I mean, I think, just to clarify a couple of things, I don't think our intention is to leave services or financial services. We just haven't come to that yet. We're doing this project one stage at a time, so those certainly aren't scoped out. And secondly, on tax, I agree absolutely what you say on tax, but I think that may be a case of having better information about tax per se, rather than necessarily doing it through this. I think it's a very legitimate issue that you raise.
What you're saying is that if you're going to create an MPM, then tell us how you get there. Yeah. Let us triangulate your MPM. You can do whatever you want. That's fine. If it's not IFRS, then map us. Let us triangulate to the actual numbers, so we can assess the economic, we can assess how egregious, ridiculous you've been, and make our own adjustments to their adjustments.
Who's not doing this?
Oh, I've loved it. If you go up and down the rating scale, large companies, small companies across jurisdictions, you might get it in the financials, you might get it once a new year, in the press releases or in the earnings, but how great would it be to have it in the financial statements auditable? That to me is, putting, it's
really creating some kind of credibility and having some people think twice about if it's going to be an audible number on the statements mappable. That's me, yeah.
Okay, my sensitivity around all of this is the model. Is that the model is something that, you know, today we have one model, and I'd be happy to change my model tomorrow if the circumstances changed. You wouldn't change the standard quickly enough for that. And I'd change it the next day, and I'd keep changing it every single day, depending on the circumstances, because the models are changing all the time, and you have to be flexible about what, you know, at one point we might have decided, we've had all these, you know, we've had U.S. tax reform, and all these companies are basically declaring great big losses because of U.S. tax reform. That's telling you something about the model that they were using, right? Because that is not an accident. That is a management decision.
Sorry, Martin. In the interest of time, can we just maybe now just take, you know, the four more comments from the people who had been putting up their signs a while ago and have been very patient, maybe not even get any responses immediately to those comments and just basically give the ISB a chance to comment on all four comments briefly at the end and then move on to the JVs, and then maybe once we get to the Q&A session of the JVs, which is also going to be a very controversial topic. Anyone who still wants to add something to the earlier discussion shall feel free to do so. Shall we do that? Okay, great. So it's my turn, actually.
That's how it works.
Well, after 20 years of research, I've learned something from this.
Well done, you.
So just three very brief comments. One is that I do agree with Glenn that this has the potential to be misleading, and I actually, sorry to be the party pooper here, but I do think this project is fairly useless and actually outright dangerous if you don't actually define the recon items. Because already at the moment, we're getting these management performance measures outside of the financial statements with full recons and the recon items. And everybody knows this is not what the IFRS thinks the EPS should be. This is, you know, some alternative measure that management has made up, and therefore it's being taken with a grain of salt. It's almost like having an automatic disclaimer in there. Once you start moving it into the financial statement, there will be a perception that these numbers are actually somehow endorsed by the IFRS and that they're auditable. I think most investors assume that the back half of the financial statements, back half of the annual report with the financial statements and notes, that's audited, and the front half is just not. So for me, the only use of having such a measure would be to actually finally have numbers like restructuring and M&A-related expenses that are being added back, to actually have them defined and have a level of assurance that companies haven't just lumped all their expenses in there. So if that's not the case, and I get an audited report saying, yeah, you know, we're actually comfortable with the number, in parentheses, even though we haven't a clue how the company calculated its restructuring expenses and its M&A-related and its other recon items, then I think that's actually more confusing than helpful. The second thing is that I think you should also be very mindful to make sure that no management team feels forced to come up with any sort of management performance measure. So there are companies out there at the moment who are saying, I don't like this at all. You know, we let investors make their own adjustments. We just report according to IFRS. And I think, you know, if basically everybody starts doing it in the financial statements and people start asking, so where's your management performance measure and your reconciliation, it will be quite difficult for management teams to say, well, you know, actually our recon items are zero because we don't, our management performance measure is identical to IFRS. And the third is just on tax. I do think with, I think it was Martin who said it, that, you know, it would be quite helpful to have, you know, the impact of the exceptionals and so forth on the tax. But I think we should also not forget that ultimately, we've had discussions in this room before that tax rates are just basically a number that the companies make up, as you sort of suggested, Geoff. And so, you know, I wouldn't really sort of like read too much into the tax rate at the best of times. Those are my comments. And then Paul, and then Bertrand, and then Mark.
Okay, I'll come on to the comment I was going to make, but first I'll just respond to your thoughts, Marietta, because nobody else is allowed to at the moment. Normally we entirely agree, but I completely disagree with at least your first and second points there. The whole point of this model is, and I thoroughly welcome it, is to allow management to express how they think we should understand their performance and then have to reconcile it to the reality. It is all about allowing management to have enough rope to hang themselves, but at least this model means we can see the rope. And that is of huge value, because we know that games are being played, but at the moment the rope is invisible. I think you have a misunderstanding of what is possible to be audited. So, because we're allowing management their own rope and to do what they choose, we have to not define the reconciliation items, because that's the whole point. It's not going to be a management performance number if we've provided all the definitions. It's going to be the board's version of a different performance number, and that's not what we're looking for. So if it's going to be an MPM, you can't have definitions. That doesn't mean that those numbers are not capable of being audited. You know, the auditors, if it's in the financial statements, will have to look at those numbers and will have to challenge how they have been arrived at and why it is that the company says they're the right numbers. And that is a really important job for the auditors to do, a really valuable job for the auditors to do. It is an audit. You know, the definitions may differ from company to company, but each company will have to justify what it has done. And we've had the little discussion about consistency year on year. That is clearly a really important thing, and a really important thing for the auditors to be doing. That wasn't what I was going to say. What I was going to say was actually just to respond to the first bit of question two, because I don't think anybody's responded on that yet. And my answer is yes. I think, you know, the discipline of having consistency between the adjustments that are made to the MPM and the adjustments that are made to EPS is quite an important part of constraining the disclosures and providing some sort of discipline in this space, just to help us understand, and I think it just gives us more opportunity to prevent things falling through the cracks. So I think that would be valuable.
Thank you, Paul. Bertrand?
Yes, I have a comment with regard to the management performance measure if it is included within the primary financial statements. I expect that within my financial statements, it will not be called management performance measure, but something like, I would say, results from operation, operating profits, operational results, and so on. And at the end, what will happen if we end up with two companies having its their own definition of their management performance measure, but with the same wording? And for the basic people that will look at the financial statements, they will think that it will be the same, and maybe it will not be the same. So how do we deal with this situation? So this is, I think, an issue we have to take into consideration.
Yes, our intention is for the management performance measure to be the term used to collectively describe these things, but probably if they're on the face of the income statement or even in the reconciliation would be to have a more accurate description of what management, like an operating profit is.
Yes, but a reconciliation outside of the primary financial statement, maybe you can understand how you come to these results, to this operating profit, to this result from operation and so on. But if it's inside the you may not have the same definition of, let's say, restructuring or some other items that are not included, and someone may include it, but the other do not include it, but in fact, because you do not think it's valuable to include it, or because the value is equal to zero. So you think you may have a sensitive, an understanding that make you comfortable, but in fact, you have not the same definition behind this.
the intention that they would describe it more accurately. That everyone call it the management policy.
Okay, maybe we'll take Mark and then Nick. Maybe you want to say some final closing comments after Mark is done, because I saw you vigorously shaking your head during my rambling. So maybe Mark and then
Nick. Just a very quick point. The location of the reconciliation, a couple of guys have suggested that it would fit nicely below the income statement, and for simple businesses, I think that is would be helpful. I guess many of the businesses I look at are quite complex with many segments, and where you've got quite a few segments, it's interesting to see which parts of the business the reconciling items apply to. So on that basis, just wanted to flag that mandating a location might work for some businesses, but it might be less appropriate for other businesses.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. I try not to shake my head so rigorously in the future. And in fact, actually, to be fair, Paul summed up many of the sentiments that I was feeling. But just to clarify, though, there is no desire or intention to force anyone to have a management performance measure if they don't have one. That is certainly not. I don't think the board has ever considered that, going down that route. Just to pick up on a couple of other small things in terms of Bertrand's comment about having perhaps misleading lines that look the same but aren't the same. That is the reality of what we have today already. So hear exactly what you say, but that situation already exists. And then just going back on Mark and segments, yes, often people want to look at this in a view in terms of segments. That would fall more in terms of thinking about the segment note, in terms of bringing that granularity there rather than in terms of what we're doing here, but understand exactly what you're saying. Yeah.
Great, thanks. So we're on to Jamie now.
I'll start and if you want to kick off. So we had this paper 2B, and if we go to slide 3 in terms of the key questions, and we debated this question with lots of passion expressed at the last CMAC meeting around joint ventures and associates. And so the questions that we have been debating on board is, where should the share of the profit or the loss of associates and joint ventures be presented in the statement of financial performance? And then secondly, is there a case of separating out integral from non-integral associates and joint venture? What we've seen, and I think if you look at any set of companies, there's an awful lot of diversity in practice here, so it undermines comparability. And certainly the sense of wanting to have a clean operating number, which was a very loud message, I think, from CMAC last time. So we find today, actually, that the returns from associates and joint ventures can be anywhere up and down the income statement. So we do want to bring some consistency and greater comparability here. We did, in our November meeting, as shown on slide 6, introduce a definition and a category of what's now called income and expenses from investments. And you can see in italics on that page how we define that category. So these were income or expenses from assets that generate return individually and largely independently of the resources held by the entity. And there were some examples of what would fall into that category without explicitly addressing associates and joint ventures at that time. Slide 7 then moved on in terms of the various options in terms of how we should present associates and joint ventures, and there was a view that all of these should be included within the investing category. And then there was a view that actually we should split the associates and joint ventures, with integral ones being presented within the what we let's call a business result and non-integral within the operating category. And there, I guess, there's still a concern that you've got associate and joint venture income within what might be the business result or operating profit, so not really achieving comparability. So we've moved on, and in January we talked again about presentation options, and still a sense, I think again we heard it at CMAC, there was value in understanding that some joint ventures and associates are very much integrated into operations today. There's a spectrum, so there was traction in terms of thinking about are the joint ventures associations, which associates that are different in nature from others. And so we started to think about could we distinguish between different types of associates and joint ventures. On slide 9, we looked at various options to do that. Could we think of U1, all joint ventures as being integral, all associates being as non-integral? View 2, which was the one favoured by the board, using the definition of investment. So in that respect, things which were operating independently of the entity would be non-integral. Those which are much more closely integrated with the business's operations would be integral. And that's where we landed. And we've taken that definition, and we've also talked about adding a set of indicators to that. But then we still come to the presentation issue, and slides 10 and 11 look at various presentation options. And if we look at probably those where we've made the split. So option 2, we have given information or split out integral from non-integral, and these both in this case fit into the investments category. Slide option 3 again makes that split, having the non-integral ones in the investment categories and the integral ones above the investing category. And option 4 on slide 11, which is the option which has been favoured by the board, is to have there a business profit subtotal, which we might think of as operating or operating profit from consolidated entities, and then beneath that to show the share of profit of integral associates and joint ventures, separate line, then another subtotal, and then the share of profits or loss from non-integral associates and joint ventures within the investment section. Now, for me, the appeal of certainly alternative 4 is that we get a pure operating EBIT, a clean number there, which is free of any associate in joint venture. Say it's called business profit here. We haven't decided what label to put on that yet. Some people are still of the mind, look, it smells and looks like operating, let's just call it operating. But that would be, in essence, operating for consolidated entities. And then I think actually having the split between integral and non-integral also provides further information. I'd be very interested to quiz management over why this is integral or why you have this big portfolio of things which aren't integral to your business. And so I think there is, one, useful information there, and two, it does reflect partly where modern corporations, how they operate today. So it's trying to do the best of both worlds. So that clean operating number, but also reflecting that there are associates and joint ventures which by their very nature could be different. That's my side. Have I missed anything?
I think that's a very good summary. Very concise. Well, thanks a lot, Nick, for saving us a lot of time.
And
then your questions, what are the most
So the questions are shown on slide 13 and 14, three questions. Do you think it's useful to present separately the share of profit or loss of integral associates and joint ventures from non-integral? And how? Question 2, how do we make that distinction? And there, obviously, the board has come up with a view. And then thinking about the alternative presentations is the third question.
Okay, great. Thank you. And so the first question was James.
Yes. So I was wondering when you're going to have this, if the integral option is taken, has the board had any thoughts on information relating to the indebtedness of those companies that are integral? So I'm thinking particularly of the REIT companies in the property space. This would be extremely useful if there's any standardization, so that you've got the integral and then you have really some required information about the debt relating to the integral.
Yep.
on helping the analyst, the reader, the investor, whatever, to have a pro rata indebtedness of that. That would be my question.
good point. I believe it is it IS 11?
IS 12
requires better disclosure, greater disclosure around what's described as strategic associates and joint ventures. There may now actually be some linkage. We could think about possibly tying that together. I'm not sure. We've always had very full information in terms of companies saying this is strategic and let's give a fuller disclosure. There's an opportunity perhaps to tie these things together. The disclosure to follow.
This is Martin, and then Jeff.
Yeah. This these ideas do raise some hairs here. I really think this seems like solving a desired full consolidation or a consolidation type of integral joint ventures by not consolidating them, but by moving them up in the income statement. And it's either you think the consolidation rule is not appropriate, and then I would want to see the revenue included as well. If you think it's an integral part of the entity, well, then we need to revisit the consolidation rule. But actually, I'm quite comfortable with the existing consolidation rule based on control. That means if you're not in control, it's not part of operating income. You're not in control. You're just not in control. So I think this is a way to, like, very judgmental, because who says whether a joint venture is integral or not? Probably the CFO. And is ISB going to provide hard criteria for whether a JV is integral or not? I don't see you do that. So it's going to be extremely judgmental between the one company and another, whether a typical joint venture is going to be considered integral or not. Could be that this, if it's a joint venture between two companies with identical rights, the one company says we consider it integral, and the other says no, not at all integral. And I think this is not the right route. I think there should be no distinction, very judgmental distinction, based on whether I never heard of it. Integral joint venture. It seems like a newspeak to get to a favorite presentation. It's really, I do not like it. Apart from that, if you somehow include these results in operating income, in EBIT, you're mixing pre-tax, pre-income, pre-interest, pre-non-consolidated, minority interest, NCI numbers. You're mixing those with numbers that are post NCI, post tax, and post interest. That means that if you want to compare margins, it's going to be a mess, because the one company may have a fairly large associate integral, and the other one not, and then you're trying to compare margins, and it becomes a mess. So I think there should be no distinction between integral and non-integral. They're just joint ventures, and we have consolidation rules. And stick to that.
I think on the latter point, the board being very cognizant of preserving that operating profit number that is comparable to your revenue, so you can do your margin. And certainly in alternative four, that is there, and there is the line which is called a business profit subtotal would include nothing that would be consolidated operating profit. So that would be
seriously, if a company wants to come up with this management view on performance, that's fine, and they can do so. But you don't need to support that from the ISB. It can be the management view. That's what the management view is for. And we have consolidation rules, and this goes against the principle, I think, of consolidation.
Okay, thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, Mark just said what I was going to say. I think you got the business profit and you got the management metric. Are they the same thing or two different things?
No, they're not necessarily the same thing.
So you could have a whole bunch of different metrics.
The business profit would be as defined before financing, before investing. It would be a gap number.
Right, okay. I suppose my big point, which Martin's kind of alluded to, is just putting net income numbers so far up the income statement. It's still a share of net income, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. That causes, I think, problems when it comes to valuation, potential double counting of numbers, people valuing to EV, capturing JVs and associates, and then learning that bridge from EV to equity value, adding back JVs and associates, and sometimes just capturing it twice. Part of me actually craves the old UK gap. I'm going back to when I was doing my qualifications, kind of 94, and you had your share of EBIT, your share of finance, your share of taxes. That just gave me plenty of disclosure to kind of play with. So that's kind of where I kind of come from. I quite like the integral, non-integral, but I think it's open to abuse. When I model, and when I get our guys to model, I try and get them to put their share of JVs and associates down below tax, and then that allows me to do things like effective tax rates a bit more consistently.
So I see Martijn's point, but I would like to say that it also does add an element of information about how management really thinks about these associates strategically, because I think nowadays you actually, management always gets a lot of questions about portfolio pruning. I mean, this, my industry at least at the moment is all about portfolio pruning. And so you then get all sorts of answers in the calls along the lines of, oh, this associate is just a financial stake, and this is a financial stake with a strategic component. You're not really sure what it means. Actually having separate classifications, I think, would speak volumes, but with the caveat that I see your point. And actually one thing that I wanted to add is that I very much like your approach in general, conceptually. I'm a little bit worried about the practicality, because I think the lines in reality between consolidated, integral, non-integral are going to be extremely blurred, and I'm actually worried that, you know, based on this, a number of these items could actually be bouncing around in the P&L over time quite a lot, because basically, I mean, companies are constantly forced to revisit their business models, they're constantly forced to think about ways to rearrange their relationships, you know, in a joint JV or with an associate, in a way that actually, where they can really bring enough to the table without committing too many resources. And it somewhat ties in with the whole discontinued operations discussion. So, I mean, I've come across a company that made a strategic decision to exit the business that was clearly no longer fitting with their strategy. But they were very unsure of how quickly they could exit, and it was all based on absorption capacity of the market and market conditions and things like that. It took them forever to even get to the point where they were willing to deconsolidate it and have it as discontinued operations. And within 3 minutes of it becoming discontinued operations, it actually became an associate, because they ceded control, did another block placement and ceded control. And it was just incredibly confusing tracking this thing through the P&L. And what I would then say is, you know, I would in that case actually at least prefer not to get any restatement. So then I would say the valuable information to me would really be to say it was consolidated during all of last year. It was a discontinued operations for the first half of this year. It was, you know, an associate for the second half of this year. Whereas, you know, if you then basically restated to always have been an associate, you just kind of lose track of how the business was looking at it a while ago, and you just have to keep tabs on, you know, why it changed and why, when it changed and why. And I don't think that's really sort of like very very helpful. And yeah, maybe, you know, there is a way to just sort of like completely not have discontinued operations anymore, but just say, you know, if you really, you know, make a strategic decision to exit, then it could be a non-integral associate until you really manage that exit. At least then you're kind of clearly telling people how you're thinking about it.
So, I mean, obviously the consolidation rules will continue to apply in terms of and that movement between operating and associates or joint ventures will be determined by the consolidation rules and nothing else. But just to be clear, I wasn't whether you were in favour of that split between integral and non-integral, or whether you'd rather not have that.
I mean, I think in principle I'd be in favor, but what I'd be very concerned about is that, well, one quarter it's going to be integral and then it's going to be non-integral and bouncing back and forth depending on, you know, whether you have one more member on the board, whether you participated in the rights issue of your joint venture partner and stuff like that.
So I was just going to address each of the questions. So in terms of whether this is a good idea, I think absolutely. I mean, we have our own accounting risk model where we flag where joint venture earnings are a large proportion of overall earnings. And I think this really sheds light on the fact that if you've got an integral JV, why are you heavily dependent on that? Now, my question, I think, has been mentioned before in terms of the definition, how this could jump around. So I guess one question is, have you thought about moving to more a rules-based definition? So if the integral JV is a certain percentage of gross assets or a set number of rules, maybe that can, you know, answer that query in that sense, which is, you know, I guess that answers the second question. But obviously, you know, I think it's good in terms of highlighting where there's a large, EJVs are largely material to the underlying operations. Now, I think this goes partway in terms of answering the query. So out of the disclosures, I think alternative two would be the preferred option, mainly for the arguments that Jeff mentioned in terms of the clarity of not having that rowing above the line. Now, I kind of have a bugbear with IFRS 11 and the fact that, you know, we don't have the opportunity for proportionate consolidation. So I guess one consideration, and I don't know if it has been considered before, is if we're showing these integral JVs, is there an argument to have additional disclosure to show what the segmental balance sheet and income statement would be for these JVs, if you want to really improve the informational quality of this?
Okay, so next, the final four comments are from Carlos, then Rosemary, then Mark, then Goro, and then I think we should be heading to... Did I not? Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Actually, I would be repeating everything else.
Sorry?
I would be repeating what has been said.
Oh, okay.
In a second, I can see the distinction. I was getting more and more anxious as I was going through the slides, looking for the distinction. And then at the end, really moment, integral is what is integrated. I got somewhat disappointed.
Thanks, Rosemary.
Again, I might be repeating what I said. I can support the alternative four, which is what's being put forward. I share Martin and Jeff's view that I think it raises more issues, and so you know, maybe just go back to the consolidation rules. So again, I can support alternative four, but I think we want to really rethink it because I think there's a number of issues it raises.
Mark.
Yeah, just to reiterate very quickly, when I look at a set of financial statements, I tend to look not just at the income statement, but to the other parts of the financial statements as well. And if we're sort of changing things on the income statement and we're saying these things integral, then the first thing I'll do is turn to the balance sheet and say, well, what investment is required, what reinvestment is required, what cash flow is being thrown off. And so if we're splitting things on the income statement, I guess the question for you guys is, what additional disclosures are we going to be giving on the balance sheet, on the cash flow statement, and the segments?
Yeah. So certainly we've discussed the cash flow statements, and I believe our tentative view was to actually show dividends separately from what had been classified as integral from non-integral. So you could see further how that flows through in terms of cash flows going back to the parent. Respect.
What about the segments and the balance sheet?
We discussed the balance sheet.
No, we haven't.
I didn't think we discussed the balance sheet yet. It's not been discussed yet.
It's on your list now, I guess.
Let's go creep.
Okay, great. Thanks. And finally, Goro, and then Bertrand, and then any closing remarks from the ISB, and then the break. Oh, and Mitch as well. Okay, well, the question is, do you guys want a break or not? maybe keep the comments relatively concise and okay. No responses to the comments until they've all been made.
It's your turn now.
Okay, go on.
First of all, I believe this is just a presentation, related to the recognition and measurement or the consolidation rule, etc. I think this is too, big issue for just to do on the presentation, and maybe that we'd better pursue this kind of things at the review of the consolidation standards. And the second, that the if this kind of reclassification of shares of profit or loss of joint venture, etc., could be done in the management performance measure so that it can be up to the management's view. And I believe that it is very difficult for the IASB to define integral, non-integral, so that I think it should be better to, in the management discretion, how they define the all these share to be included in operating or business profit or something.
Bertrand?
Yes, one comment. By moving up the share of profit and loss of integral associate and GVs, there is the issue that you will end up with mixing some pre-tax and pre-interest activities with post-tax and post-interest activities. So you have a result that is a kind of mixture. And there is also the issue of the consistency with the balance sheet and the cash flow. So I don't see this way. And the second point also is, as you some said, about the definition of integral versus non-integral, how it works. So this is that's the issue.
Thank you. Mitch?
Promise will be done by 11 o'clock. Very quickly for me, I think sometimes in our quest for more information and greater disclosure, we sometimes maybe overshoot a little bit. And I wonder if there's a little bit of overkill here that creates some confusion, allows management to, Marietta's point for, I think, manipulation of earnings into quarter end to suddenly classify something one way or the other. And then the secondary tertiary effects of something like this in terms of reporting just the volumes of information required could make it harder. So some resistance and skepticism here.
Great, thanks. So that leaves a full 3 minutes for you, Nick.
Great. Well, I promise not to take them all. So I guess what I'm hearing are a number of things. One, mixed views on whether it's worth making this split between integral and non-integral, although equally a sense that we're not getting very good disclosures on significant associates today. The debt in particular was mentioned, and this would be a way of trying to tie that back, another opportunity to tie that back. A sense that we don't want to elevate these too far up the income statement, and I think we already recognise that there's a huge diversity. Lots of these measures are quite high up the income statement already today, despite being post-tax and post-financing. That's the reality. I'd say most are quite high up. There are very few which are low down. But still, also the importance of having a clean operating number, which can be compared to revenue on a like-for-like, so free of any associates and joint venture. I think that's a message that I've heard is important. Is that fair to say? Something that's like for like, but mixed views elsewhere in terms of how we deal with associates and joint ventures.
Excellent, thank you. So that leads us to the coffee break, and we'll resume promptly at 11:15, please. Thank you.